So this is when we're kind of really moving into the final section here of the book. So let me reestablish it, and we'll finish up Genesis here sometime in the near future. So marks the beginning of the end of the final act in Genesis. The nation is going to get resettled in Egypt, beginning here in chapter 46. And then the patriarchal leadership is going to reach its end, right? So remember, Genesis, simple organization. First 11 chapters, kind of pre-patriarchal history. We have the creation, you know, fall, flood, and then the dispersion. And then from chapter 12 forward, we have the patriarchs of the nation of Israel. Now, generally, we think of it as Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Joseph is not really a patriarch in the sense that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are. So we have the three major patriarchs, and they cover the story through the end of the book of Genesis. So we have the end of that patriarchal history coming to an end here. And it's going to give way to a theocratic judgeship where God's going to rule through his appointed judges, the first and most famous of whom is Moses. Right? So he's going to dominate the rest of the Pentateuch. And then once you get to that, he's going to hand off to Joshua. Then we're going to have the book of Judges when we see this cycle of apostasy and falling down. And Judges ends with this telling statement, right? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And then, of course, we start to move into the, you know, the kings and things of that nature. So you're kind of seeing how God is working through different leaders in the process. Now, outline-wise, chapter 46 through the first 12 verses of 47 deal with the resettlement in Egypt. Then in chapter 47, verses 13 to 26, we just get a little kind of summary. The legacy of Joseph's leadership. Kind of gives us the end times, what winds down relative to the end of the famine period, okay, and how Joseph kind of wraps up that time and how he does those things. From there, in chapter 47, 27 through the end of chapter 48, Joseph will be blessed and will receive his portion. So when we start chapter 48, we're going to see that Jacob is now finally, 17 years later, on his last legs, and he's going to do what every patriarchal leader does, is he's going to pass on his blessing to the family. And we're going to get some interesting prophecy when we get into chapter 49 on that. But basically, Joseph receives that first as kind of the firstborn. 49 to 50, we actually get Joseph's prophetic blessings to each of his 12 sons. And then finally, we have this little magnanimous pardon, kind of the whole theme point, right? God, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. And that's kind of the closing note of the book of Genesis. So that's how the rest of the book unfolds, and we will start to march our way through that. So in 46 through 47:12, we're going to see the resettlement in Egypt. So this marks an inflection point in their history, and we're going to leave the promised land, and they're going to embark upon what is going to be a 400-year sojourn into Egypt, right? Now, this had been prophesied, correct, back earlier in the book of Genesis. So this is now the trigger event that God's going to use to move the family down into Egypt. Yet it's a necessary step to grow the nation and to pursue their national integrity. So remember, I said some of this, I think, was being driven by God sequestering the nation. They'd had problems in Canaan, right, becoming integrated with the Canaanites around them. God didn't want that to happen, so this is how he's going to sequester them to get it. Egypt is the place to do it, not only for the obvious reason, right, which is the famine, but also for developing a distinct national identity and consciousness, okay? So this is where the nation is finally going to begin to grow and fulfill those promises, right? Remember how he used to tell Abram what was his progeny going to be like? Stars of the sky, sands of the seas, okay? So this abundant number of people, and this is where this is going to begin to come about. And secondly, for preventing them from becoming amalgamated into the larger culture that surrounds them. So we'll see, and I'll show you a couple pictures here in a second, that they're going to put them in this kind of perfect place where they can be isolated and form together as a nation, develop that identity, and not intermingle with the surrounding cultures. So it's a perfect place because the Egyptians had pride and disdain for foreigners in general, and particularly for shepherds, right? So we're going to see how Joseph uses this to secure the piece of ground and the permission from Pharaoh to have that piece of ground. Secondly, it's geographically isolated away from the cities, Okay, so it is geographically isolated where they're going to settle down in Goshen. And there's no possibility of intermarriage, so they're going to be able to maintain ethnic purity. So one of the big things throughout all of Israel's history was God trying to get the nation to maintain their ethnic purity, and they were always struggling with that, right? When they were in the nation, intermarrying and all the different things like that. So on the positive side also, they were able to take advantage of the advances in the Egyptian culture. Okay, so the society was quite advanced. They could take advantage of those advanced things, learn from them, but they could stay sequestered from the other things. So all in all, they could grow and develop their national identity while they await the testing that's going to come later from severe persecution, which will ultimately lead to their redemption and deliverance, which we're going to see recorded in the book of Exodus, right? So you kind of just see how the story moves along, you know, and it's going to take some big jumps, right? So we're going to leave Genesis, and the next thing you know, we're going to jump into Exodus, and there's going to be millions of them, right? So obviously quite a few years have passed before that time, but yet we see how they're recording what's important. Now, structure-wise, the chapters lay out like this. First four verses of chapter 46, we're going to see Jacob, or Israel called here, sacrifice and seek affirmation for this move that he's taking. In verses 5 to 27, we have this long section on recording the families. We're going to look at a few things in that. We're not going to kill ourselves in terms of thinking through all those different names, but there are some issues that arise in that that we'll take a look at. We have the emotional reunion finally in verses 28 to 30, and Joseph's resettlement wisdom, his plan to get him settled where he wants in 31 to 34. And then there's the actual resettlement itself that happens in the first 12 chapters of chapter 47. Okay, so it kind of progresses through the process. Big chunk of it dealing with kind of the generations that went down there. So we'll pause on that and think about why the emphasis, and there are a couple textual things we'll deal with as we get to that. We will not get to that this week because we have to have continuity on those details as we go through it. So we'll get through the first four. So somebody read, please, for me, first four verses of chapter 46.
So Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes."
Okay, so this is the starting point. His mind made up. Israel is referred to here, right? So he's been renamed. Sometimes goes back and forth between Israel, sometimes Jacob, right? The kind of basic distinction is when he's referred to as Jacob, it's kind of his old fleshly self. Israel, kind of his new, if you will, reborn. I'm not going to push that too far, but the idea of kind of acting as God would want him to act. So his mind made up, he sets out for Egypt. And the journey starts in Hebron, where the family had been living since their return from Haran, okay? Now, they pause to worship in Beersheba. So let me just kind of give you a little picture. Yeah. Doesn't want to behave today. Yeah, it doesn't do that. Excuse me. Get out of here for a second. Jump down. All right, so they started up in Hebron. See the blue circle up there? Up in your top right. And they're on these major two roads. So there's kind of a sea road that comes down, and there's an internal road. These are just trade routes that have been moving through that part of the land. And they had come down to Beersheba, okay? So it's kind of where they're ultimately going down here. See Goshen on the left-hand side? So this is in the fertile Nile Valley in terms of modern-day Egypt. So that's kind of where they are physically as they're moving their way down. Excuse me. Okay, we won't do that again. All right, so they pause to worship in Beersheba. And Beersheba is about 25 miles from Hebron. So with that group and kind of how far they would travel in a day, it was probably his second day of travel. Okay, so they left Hebron, they're moving down, they're going down towards Egypt. And the question that kind of comes to my mind was, why did Jacob wait to get to Beersheba, or why didn't he immediately start by sacrifice and seeking affirmation in Hebron before he even set out? Why do you think that might be the case? David?
In verse 28, it says, I will go and see him before I die. So maybe he didn't take a day for granted.
Okay, that's a good one. I got a kind of a twist on that. That's possible. Not taking any days for granted at this point in time. Yeah, what else comes to mind? What else do you think? Other thoughts? Yeah.
I'm just guessing this.
It's okay.
I think that's closer to where the promised land would be.
That's kind of an interesting, there is something about the promised land there. So let me get to that. So you're kind of on the right track with that, and there's a couple other things. So a text doesn't really say, okay? So yeah. Since Ken only gave me half a coin on one of my speculations a couple weeks ago, I want to be very careful not to sanctify my speculation too much. I always got to get reined in just a little bit. The text doesn't really say, but a couple of possibilities. Close to David's, okay? Okay, I'm not wasting a day, but I'm so overwhelmed, okay, with the prospect of seeing Joseph that I want to get going, right? So I don't want to wait. Also probably a strong sense already of divine providence, right? Owing to a couple of things, the brother's personal testimony and the evidence of Joseph's prominence in Egypt, okay? So there were certainly circumstances that would have very clearly suggested this was the right thing to do. So I don't think it was purely an act of self-will on Jacob's part. More likely, though, is this. Beersheba was at the time the southern extremity of the promised land. So to the idea here of Gary, the idea of southern extremity. So he's traveled from Hebron, he's reached Beersheba, which is the southern boundary at that time of the promised land. So he's about to leave the place where God had directed his forefathers to go and settle. And I think he has the good sense, recognizing the momentous nature, to kind of sit back and seek a little clarity before he goes any further. Okay, so we're seeing some of his spiritual maturity in the process. He realizes that God hasn't spoken directly to him yet regarding this endeavor, and Jacob has a history of God speaking to him, right? So, secondly, he likely remembers there had been previous self-willed pilgrimages to Egypt, right? Okay, remember. And that hadn't turned out so well, right? So Abram's sojourn down there. Secondly, he also remembered a similar period of famine when Isaac was going to go down, right? And what did Isaac do? So go back to Genesis 26 for a second. Kind of very similar characteristics to what Jacob is facing right now. And in chapter 26, verses 1 to 5, it says this. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and will give your descendants all these lands. And by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abram obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So, reaffirmation, of course, of the Abrahamic covenant and key conditions of the covenant, but a specific charge by God to say, don't go down there, I'll take care of you where you are. Okay, so I think that Jacob, certainly having grown up with his father and would have heard those stories, brought all these things to mind as he was getting kind of to the end of the current promised land scenario. So, better late than never, he pauses to sojourn to seek divine guidance at this point. Now, we might also note that Beersheba was a significant historical site, right? An awful lot of things went on at Beersheba in the account we've had to date. It's where Hagar encountered the angel of the Lord, right? First time when she had taken the child out, he told her to go back. It's where the covenant between Abram and Abimelech was consummated. It's also where Abraham's home base after the offering of Isaac. Okay, so when he came back from Isaac, it was home base. It was where the Lord appeared to Isaac to confirm the covenant blessings. So in chapter 26, a little later from where we just read. It is where the second covenant with Abimelech was made, right? Okay, this time between Isaac and another Abimelech. Abimelech is just a general name for a king. And it's Isaac's home from where Jacob departed to Haran after his deception. Okay, so it was a well-known family place. So maybe more than you wanted to think about, but Beersheba is certainly a reasonable spot, if not the ideal place for Jacob to pause and to worship. Is it this light or that? What's flickering? The screen?
No. No,
not so. Oh, the light.
That happened.
Okay. All right. I guess we'll have to talk to the supplier about that. Okay. It's an inside joke. They do look nice, though. Very bright. Okay, so Jacob offers his sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. Now, why the qualifier? Why does he say to the God of his father, Isaac? Okay, again, no clear textual answers, okay, but perhaps something in the context of patriarchal solidarity, okay, so the same God that he did, or maybe childhood memories of Beersheba, but I don't know why he does specify the God. He wants to be very specific about who he's going to make these sacrifices to. Now, we're not told if Jacob made any specific petitions, but in verse 2, God speaks to Jacob in visions of the night, note the plural, multiple visions. So during the course of that night, God appeared and spoke to Jacob or Israel in various visions, which would surely cause Jacob to recall prior patterns, right? He had been spoken to that way before, and he would sit up and take notice. Now, based upon verses 3 and 4, even though we don't have specific requests made by Jacob that are recorded, what might you surmise was on his mind, based upon what God says in verses 3 and 4? What do you think might have been on Jacob's mind?
He was concerned to going down to Egypt, that in some way he'd be harmed.
Okay, so probably some fear about going down there. What else? Oh yeah, maybe the idea, will I ever come back? But I don't know. Does God make any comment about whether I come back? He said, "I am God, the God of your father."
Means he's going to be there for a while.
Yeah, that's true. Oh yeah, no, you're right. And I will also surely bring you up again, right? Yep, absolutely right. Verse 4. So yeah. So hey, am I ever going to come back from this? So God reassures him: A, okay to go. You'll be all right. B, I'll bring you back. Okay. So good thoughts. So kind of one idea is God with me, right? I mean, is God really with me in this process? Secondly, as Ken said, is it okay to go? I mean, you know, I'm leaving the land. I remember you told my father Isaac not to go, so maybe I'll just check with you and make sure, right? I've got all these kind of circumstantial things that suggest maybe it's good to go, but nice to get some affirmation. And then, as she said, as Viv said, will I ever return? Okay, so kind of all natural things, right? I mean, is this a permanent deal, temporary deal? I don't know what you call 400 years, certainly a long deal, okay, but obviously God says it. Now, what does God do first in the vision? What does God first do? What's the first thing he does in the vision? In terms of speaking to him, what does he do first? Yeah.
Well, he says, "I'm the God of your father."
Yeah, okay.
He affirms that.
All right, so he affirms his identity. I am the God, the very same God of your father, okay? So he wanted to, you know, he makes his offering to the God of Father, the God of my fathers. God specifically affirms, I'm that one. I'm the one that's speaking to you. Okay, so we get that first step. What does God do next?
He's promising a blessing.
What's that?
Is he promising a blessing?
Yeah, he is promising a blessing. He's certainly going to do that. That's a good point. I didn't say that. He does. He tells them what he's going to do when he's down there. So he's kind of affirming again the Abrahamic covenant and the blessing. You're going to grow into a great nation down there. But I think he quells any fear that Jacob has about going down to Egypt. Okay. So the nature of the fear is not clear. It was either fear of leaving the land without clear divine sanction, or fear of what would happen in Egypt, or probably both, if you think about it in the process. Then God provides a reason for why they should not be afraid. This gets to the comment here by Suzanne just a second ago, and that is, this is where the great multitude promises of the Abrahamic covenant are going to be fulfilled. Okay, so, yeah, it's okay to go. I'm going to bring you back, and here's what's going to happen while you're there. So, yeah, I guess he gets certainly a clue that they're going to be there a while, because it's going to be a while to create great multitudes. Yeah, Matthew.
What do you make of that comment? I'll bring you back. Did he mean in a box?
Yeah. I think he was speaking to him as the federal head, if you will, of the nation in that regard. And yeah, he is going to bring him back in a box, which as we get into the next chapters, he's going to ask for and say, hey, you know, make sure you don't bury me down here. So I think he's pretty clear that he's not coming back. But I think he's speaking to him as kind of the, if you would, everybody, I understand the idea of a federal head. Okay, so as the federal head, the representative of the nation of Israel, he's basically telling him that I'm going to bring the nation back. Okay, not necessarily a specific promise to him, but I think a promise that the nation is going to be brought back. Yeah.
Just reading the text here, it says, "Fear not, go down into Egypt, for I will go there and make thee a great nation," what mm-hmm. he promised to Abraham.
Exactly.
And that was being fulfilled in Egypt.
Exactly right. Yep. Yeah, so that's what he's doing. So, I mean, he's just telling him, he's unveiling the plan. I mean, this is really the one thing that hasn't happened, yeah. Right? You think of all the promises. Yeah, Ken.
It's important to remember, he's still a family. It's a big family. It's
right.
This is where they grow and become a nation. And so it's still a family moving to Egypt.
Yeah, it's not big at all. I mean, so, you know, we'll get into the 70 or 75 issue next week. And then they don't count the women and children and things of that nature. They count some of the male children, the heirs, and so forth. But I don't know, maybe it's 200 people with all their slaves and everything else with them. It's not a big group. And as your point, yeah, he's going to now fulfill that portion of that covenant that was made, yeah. And he's getting foresight into that whole scenario. So yeah, it is interesting. I mean, God does reveal his plans, doesn't he? Now, God doesn't reveal everything, does he?
Nope.
Right? We went through that for a few weeks of excursus, right? But the fact is, God reveals what he wants you to know. And he tells us what you want to know when you need to know it. And so that's what he's helping him understand as he goes through the process. So clearly, Jacob's concerns are not voiced, but God obviously knows what those concerns are, and he is quelling those concerns as he goes through that. Now, what does God do next? I've kind of jumped ahead a little bit, but what does he do towards the end of this process here? What's one of the key things that God's doing?
He reassures him that he'll be with him.
Right. That's the key. He's affirming his presence with Jacob, right? And it's really stated very emphatically in the Hebrew. Okay? You can always pull the subject out of the Hebrew verb. When you have the actual pronoun and the verb, that's the way they do emphasis. So when you see that in the Hebrew, what he's literally saying in translation is, I myself will go down with you. Okay, so God is going to go down with him to this promised land. Okay, so very emphatic. And then secondly, he emphatically promises that he's going to bring him back. Okay, I will surely, and it's funny, they do that by a combination of an imperative and an infinitive. They use the same verb and they repeat it. Okay, I will surely, surely, basically, is kind of what it would translate if you just did it literally. So I will surely bring you back, okay? The actual word is bring back. I'll bring you back, I'll bring you back. So I'll surely bring you back. So God's very emphatic about the fact that he's going down with him and that he will indeed bring them back out of the captivity, which fulfills what? Prophecy that was made earlier in Genesis, right? You're going to go down for a period of 400 years. I'm going to do that, and then I'll bring you back to the land. Okay, now, in the 400 years, why do you think the 400 years? Why 400 years? Why not 500? Why not 100? Why not 200? You probably could have a big group after a couple hundred years, I imagine. You can't know it from this text. I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit. So, I can't remember exactly where it is. You scholars that have your scriptures memorized. This is when I miss Katie the most. She knows where they all are. But as we get further in, they're down there until the iniquity of what? Canaan is complete. So in addition to taking the time to build and grow them into a great multitude, he's providing ample time for Canaan to repent. And so God will be just in his judgment when he comes back and he brings the nation into the promised land. Okay, so it's a punishment for their iniquity for those many years. So God is what? Long-suffering, patient, kind and all those processes, so he gives them a long period of time. So, you know, 400 years certainly should be enough time. The you in verse 4 is singular, but it carries this corporate nuance. Matthew, this gets to your idea, okay, the federal head kind of idea. I will bring you. It is actually singular, but him singular as the federal head of the nation. I will bring you as the representative of the nation or the nation back in the process. So you as the head of the nation. So it's not just Jacob's bones that will return to Canaan, as we will learn later, right, in the came. He says, don't bury me down here. And Joseph is going to ask for the same thing, but he's going to bring them back. But rather, God's going to go down with the nation of Israel, and he will bring the nation back. Now, these are some rich promises of reassurance at the time of deep uncertainty, right? So, you know, God is being gracious to Jacob at this point in time, right? He's about to make a big move, right? And God reassures him before he takes this step. Now, good implications for us, right? I mean, what he's sacrificing, what would be our equivalent of sacrificing if we want to go before the Lord today? Would be what? How would we go before the Lord today? To seek his counsel? In prayer. Okay, look for the simple solution. I don't think Mark wants you sacrificing any lambs on the altar up there. Might taste good, but yeah, we go through prayer, right? And we should expect that we will have prayers answered. Now, not only always when we want, not always how we want, but as we're praying in God's will, as we're praying for his discernment in things, we can expect that he will answer us in those processes. Now, how does the vision end? What's the final part of the vision there? Yeah, who said that? Okay, yeah, he's going to learn, he's going to die in Egypt. So this is Matthew's further affirmation. He knows he's not going back other than in a box. But how about the sweetness of it at the end, right? And your son, your long-lost son, who you love, he'll be the one that closed your eyes. So kind of a gentle, kind reassurance. You're not going to die alone. You're going to die in the presence of your son. So reassurance that he's going to make it down there and see him, but then that will be the final time. So he goes down at, 130 years old or so, and he's going to actually live 17 more years when he's down there. But what a sweet reassurance by the Lord in terms of the final thing. Instead of dying in sorrow, right, what did he say? Bring my gray hair down to Sheol if I lose my other son Benjamin. He's going to have this sweet, sweet reunion with his beloved lost son Joseph, who will be at his side on his deathbed and will provide a last loving act, closing his father's eyes. Okay, so kind of a sweet thing that he does there at the end. A couple of interesting observations I think we ought to make before we leave the section, and we'll break with these observations this week because we won't start in on that. What God specifically forbid for Abraham and Isaac, he is now permitting for Jacob. Okay, so twice he had forbid Abraham to do it. Abraham did it in disobedience and had some results. Isaac was forbidden and he obeyed, okay, which does not make God fickle or inconsistent, okay, just means that he has differing guidance in different circumstances at different times. That is consistent with his greater and always and not always revealed plan, right? So, you know, it makes me think of kind of the book of John as Jesus is restoring Peter. Remember how the process goes? He kind of walks him out with Peter and he tells Peter, and this is the manner, and you're going to die, right? What does Peter say after that? Yeah, what about that guy? How's he going to die? And what does Jesus say? Yeah, right. He used the Giuseppe, right? What's the matter to you? What's the matter to you? He said, how he dies, he dies. And if he doesn't die, he doesn't die. The fact of the matter is, God reveals what he wants to reveal, and he keeps secret what he wants to keep secret in the process. So we kind of see that sweet end to the process. So kind of a rich start to this section here, right? I think we see just God's great reassurance with that. We see God providing information and detail about what's going to happen down there. And then as we move into verses 5 to 27, which we'll take up next week, we're going to begin to see kind of this, I call it a selected manifest, shipping manifest. We see kind of a selected list of the goods, meaning the people in this case, that are going to go down to Egypt. So kind of think through this week as we get ready for next week. Why does he pause to do this at this point in time? Why do we get this detail at this point in time, right? Because we've seen genealogies throughout the book of Genesis. So why is he pausing here? Why is he making us read all these names that we can't pronounce, right? What's the key to what's kind of happening in this process here? What is the meaning of this particular pause to give us a genealogy that's going down there? Okay? All right. Any questions? Yeah, Matthew.
Your point that you made earlier, I think, is so wonderful, and that's God's goodness and kindness, and that we are all called to obey him. And he's not obliged to tell us the specifics, how things are going to turn out, in order to give us a confidence. But our confidence needs to be in him, his goodness, his faithfulness, his kindness. Now, from time to time, like we've seen here, he condescends in his mercy to give him some sight. We see that in our lives. Sometimes we actually see fruits of your ministry, like you pray for your kids and you see how they respond. But God's not obligated to give that to us.
Right.
We are yet to trust him.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And, you know, it shouldn't be a very hard point for us to grasp, right? All of you that are mothers and fathers in here and raised children. I remember one time talking to Pastor Eric, and he just blew me off my feet. He was talking about raising the kids, and I don't know how it came up, but he said, kids were asking why, and I asked him, what did he say? I said, you're not allowed to ask why. I said, really? That's interesting. Now, Eric, you'll learn to know that Eric doesn't just say things. Tell me about that. I wasn't a believer when I had young kids, and they asked a lot of whys, and I gave a lot of silly answers. But the fact of the matter was, what he said was, he said, they're too young to ask that question. They can't grasp why. And it's kind of, I think it's a good reminder for us as God's children, right? There are some whys that we can't grasp, right? And it's these big pickle items that we deal with, like, so how do we justify sovereignty and suffering? Well, that's a why that we can't answer. It's beyond our pay grade, and God doesn't answer that question. He just tells us both are true. So to pick up on Matthew's comment, I think it's right. I mean, we have times, and as your children get older, right, and they're able to handle more information, and they're able to, with maturity, deal with more issues, then you're able to give them more reasons and more explanation. So the idea is that here, I guess, Jacob was ready. But remember what we've been talking about in this whole journey getting to this point. All of this has been God's preparation to get them to the point where he's going to do what he's been planning to do, right? And it was just this one thing, to get him down there. So all this lead up was to get him down there and get everybody in place to do it, so that God could accomplish the next step in his providential plan, which was to grow the nation, and then what's coming next? They're going to have the persecution, and then they're going to return to the land. We just see this amazing providence. So that's what's beautiful about the whole scriptures for us, right? We have them, so we can look at them. We really don't have any excuse. We can look at it, see it, and if we're honest, we shouldn't harden our hearts to that process.